You're listening to Season 2, Episode 16 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, Storyteller Tribe! Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Gotham Writers for sponsoring today's episode. They teach creative writing classes in New York City and online and have built an incredible writing community. Be sure to hang around at the end of the show to find out why Gotham has earned an amazing reputation within the writers community. We have author Jessica Brody with us on the show today. Jessica's written and published multiple books in various genres. Two of her young adult novels were acquired for feature film adaptations being made by producers who produced Vampire Academy, Life of Pi, and Slumdog Millionaire. I'm super excited to share today's episode with you because it's fully focused on the technicalities of writing, the kinds of writing programs and softwares that work the best for writers, how marketing and social media impacts the sales of books and the engagement of readers, very specific writing rituals that help get writers out of a block, and so much more. Now let's jump right in. Hey guys! Oh my goodness, we have Jessica Brody with us today. I am so excited to have her on the show. Jessica, what's up? How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my goodness, I'm super, super pumped. And we were talking a little bit earlier about how we actually have mutual friends. And I actually heard about you first through one of my best friends, Mickey Shaloa, and he was in one of your book trailers 4 years ago, I believe. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, this is so great. Yeah, and Mickey's, you know, one of my favorite people ever. So now even more so.
This is awesome. Well, let's kick it off. How did you first fall in love with writing and why do you write?
I think I first fell in love with writing in the second grade when I was asked by my teacher to write a book report. And she told us it had to be a paragraph long and I turned in 4 pages, which is funny because my editor would probably laugh at that joke because I tend to overwrite and she ends up have to cut a lot. So I turned in 4 pages and my teacher, she kind of freaked out and she was like, showing everyone in the school, all the teachers, she was like, look what Jessica Brody did. She wrote all these words. And I remember thinking, that was easy. Why is she making such a big deal about it? Like, she's clearly, you know, not getting this. And I think that was the first clue that I had that writing came easy to me. And not a lot of things came easy to me. Like, I was never good at sports. I was a really slow reader. So I think when that happened, I kind of got the bug and the praise that she gave me for that. I was like, why is someone praising me for something that comes so easily? That's really kind of what planted the seed.
I know that you're very aware then that you're like, okay, this is a natural gift that you have. So in college, did you go straight for a creative writing degree?
It's funny you ask that because one of the things, the stories I love to tell is that I never thought of writing as a career. Like, it was always this really fun thing. And I think in the back of my mind, I thought, well, how could it be a career if it's this fun? And so I never took it seriously as a career option. And for that reason, I did take a creative writing class in high school, one. But then in college, I majored in economics.
What?
And French.
Girl, yeah. You are so smart. My goodness.
Well, I don't know about that, but I was convinced that, you know, in order to have a good job, it had to, you know, come with dental insurance and have like a really high paycheck. And so I went into business and I majored in economics. I got a job as a financial analyst at MGM Studios and I was just writing for fun on the side. And then MGM got bought out by Sony in 2005. Oh my gosh, it's been so long. In 2005, Sony bought MGM and everyone got laid off. And while all my colleagues went and got another job at another studio, I was like, wait a minute, I could take my, you know, severance package and I could write a book and like live off of this. And that's what I decided to do. And then I haven't, you know, haven't gone back since. I still love my spreadsheets, but now I use them to help like plot my novels.
That's so crazy because I'm so used to hearing writers saying, hell no, get spreadsheets away from me. I don't want to see numbers, nothing like that. But this is insane. I know that you actually recently just released Boys of Summer. So along those lines, what's really exciting you about your work right now?
I always try to challenge myself as a writer. I think with every book, this Boys of Summer is my, I think, ninth or tenth. I lose track. But I always try to challenge myself. So, you know, I started out, I wrote two books for adults, and then I decided to write for teens. And so that was the big challenge. I switched to young adult fiction. And I wrote three kind of romantic comedies, The Karma Club, My Life Undecided, and 52 Reasons to Hate My Father. And then I decided I wanted to challenge myself again, and I wrote a young adult sci-fi trilogy, which I'd never written sci-fi before. That was super fun. And when I finished the trilogy, I kind of was like, well, what's next? You know, what have I not done? And I realized, actually, because I found my high school diary, which was like just chocked full of boys. There was just like a different boy on every page. I was so boy crazy in high school. And I realized I had never written from a boy's point of view. And I felt like I had explored, not only in my teenage diary, but in all of these books, I had explored teen drama and teen relationships from the girl's point of view because that was familiar to me. But I was like, what are the boys thinking when, you know, in these relationships? So, you know, similar to me in high school, I couldn't choose just one boy. So I picked three boys to write about. And I wrote this book, Boys of Summer, which is basically about these three best friends. They all vacation on the same island every summer. And they're used to these really carefree, chill, laid back summers where nothing, they have no worries. And then this summer, everything is different because they are all dealing with a personal tragedy that has happened over the past year. And it's totally going to change the shape of their friendship. And then, of course, there's like love triangles and, you know, there's,
yes,
there's
all the juicy stuff. I love that.
Yeah, the juiciness. So it was really fun because I got to write from three different boys' points of view. It was really fun to just explore that side of love. Pretty much.
How was your research process like for writing in those three best friends' points of view who are all boys? Did you talk to your husband about when he was younger?
So I felt like I was kind of going into it blind because I grew up with a sister. So I definitely grew up in more of a girl feminine house and, you know, more feminine energy around me. But I always had guy friends growing up, even now. Like I have a lot of guy friends. And I think that is where I started to originally pull from. And then, yeah, I did talk to my husband a lot about it. My editor has, I think, more than one brother, but I think she might be the only girl in the family. And so she had a lot of, yeah, she helped a lot with some of the input. And then, you know, I would have, if I was unsure about a scene, I'd give it to my husband to read and he would just start slashing stuff. And he's like, you know, guys don't think like that. Guys don't say things like that. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I think it started out a much longer book because I was like, well, girls, you know, analyze every single thing, every single word. And I was kind of doing that from the boy's point of view. And he was like, no. So it was an interesting process. It's funny because it's the first book, you know, I'm not trying to stereotype boys or anything, but it's the first of my teen books that actually has swear words in it. Like I usually try to keep my books pretty clean, but I realized like, you know, these are three 18-year-old dudes. Like they're not going to be saying like, gosh, dang it. You know, so I definitely had to step it up on that side to make it more believable.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm sure they're like horny as hell. So I'm sure you had to like get into that mindset too.
I had to curb that a little bit. I was like, okay, I can't have them thinking about boobs all the time. Like, you know, they can have the thoughts.
Let's give the girl readers some hope.
Right. I do think there's a little bit of like wishful thinking in the way I wrote it. You know, if you look at the cover, you can see the book is a little bit marketed towards girls.
I was going to say, I love the cover.
Yeah.
It's got a very classy touch to it. It really does.
Yeah. It's like, oh, boys on the cover without shirts. So great. But I think, yeah, I think I kind of tried to put a little bit of wishful thinking in as like, the girls hope that boys are having some of these thoughts. You know, yes. Sometimes they're not always what we want, but I tried to at least put a little bit of that in there.
I love that. And I'm sure there's lots of boys out there who are like that. You know, it's just like not enough people write about them. So thank you to you. You're like their spokesperson.
Well, what's been really fun about these three boys is they're all very different. You know, Grayson is the kind of golden boy troublemaker. He's a football player. Like he's got, everyone thinks his whole life is perfect and planned out. And of course it's not, you know, he's dealing with all sorts of questions when it comes to his future. And then Mike is like the local heartthrob who's this hopeless romantic surfer. And he's been with the same girl since he was 12, but she's just recently changed her mind about their future. And then Ian is this kind of sarcastic musician with a father who's in the army who did not come back from his last deployment. So he's dealing with grief and he's used to, you know, really relying on his sarcasm to get him through all of these hard times, but that's before he lost his dad. And so they're all kind of dealing with different things, and they're all so different. And what I love doing when I talked to teens about this book and adults, you know, is I ask the girls, I'm like, so who do you think you'd like? The sarcastic musician, the hopeless romantic surfer, the golden boy troublemaker? And everyone's got an opinion. They're like, I want the sarcastic musician. So I actually made up little like boy trading cards that that you can get, you know, if you come to any of my events. I always have them and I hand them out. There's a Who's Your Boy of Summer quiz on my website, which you can go to jessicabrody.com/boys of summer, and you can find out like who your boy is, or if you are a guy, who you most identify with. So it's just been like a really funny, almost like Harry Potter-esque sorting house thing. Or sorting hat.
I have to say, as a side note, I really admire you. Your marketing is really quite brilliant, and I want to get into that. I'll touch on that later, but about the characters, I think that's so fascinating that you were able to get deep into the mindsets of three totally different guys, yet also like find that common bond. Through your writing process, do you usually write with outlines? How do you write so that you're not lost when you're trying to get into three different characters' mindsets, you know?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big outliner. I never start a book until I have kind of a full outline. I've tried doing chapter outlines, but I find that I can never quite stick to them because I always linger too long on one thing that I didn't think was important, or I will linger less time on stuff that I did think was important, and the chapters just end up kind of shaping themselves. But what I do is I use a very specific screenwriting method called Save the Cat, which is based on
Blake Snyder.
Yeah, Blake Snyder's book. It's amazing. I am actually one of the master cats. I teach novelists how to use Save the Cat for Blake Snyder's company because I'm a huge fan of it. So basically it breaks down all stories into 15 beats or plot points. And they have fun names too, like the fun and games and the bad guys close in and the catalyst. I never start writing until I have the 15 beats complete. And what was kind of fun about this book is not only it's my first book from a boy's point of view, it's my first book from multiple points of view. So they're each, you know, every chapter alternates between the boys and they're all first person. And so what I had to do is I had to create three beat sheets. So they're all three boys have all 15 beats. So that was really fun. And then I would just kind of weave the stories together in what to me felt like a natural way.
Wow. Okay. So I need to know, because I know you mentioned like a few minutes ago about transitioning from writing for adults to young adult. Like you first wrote two books for adults and then transitioned to young adult. Do you remember that moment specifically that inspired you to write for the young adult genre?
Yes, it was actually a very specific moment. And I like to think it was almost like an accident that I fell into the young adult genre because I was writing for adults and I'd never thought about writing for teens. I mean, I hadn't read a teen book since I was a teen. Like, I didn't think, I'm like, why would I write for teens? I'm not a teen. it never crossed my mind. And then I had this idea that I thought was a brilliant idea for an adult novel. And I pitched it to my agent and I was like, oh, it's about three 30-year-old women who band together to take karma into their own hands and get revenge on everyone who's been mean to them. And my agent was like, 30-year-old women running around getting revenge on people, that sounds really sad. And I was like, oh. And so I kind of, you know, the first thing that popped in my head, I was like, well, what if they're not 30? What if they're only 17? And she was like, oh, that's funny. So I decided I wanted to write it as a teen novel, but of course I'd never written a teen novel. I hadn't read teen novels in a while. So I had to do a lot of research. I went out and bought a whole bunch of teen books and I didn't expect to like them. I thought, what do I have in common with these readers? And I ended up just falling in love with these books. And I was like, oh, okay. Maybe I am still a teen at heart. But anyway, I wrote about 50 pages of it and I sent it to my agent. And she was like, wow, you have a really natural voice for a teen girl. And I was like, is that a compliment? But I got the bug. And I actually realized in that moment that I really loved writing for teens. And it felt more natural to me than writing for adults.
I don't know what it is for me personally, but there's just this hurdle, like this 20-foot brick wall I feel like I have to climb. And girl, I have no upper strength. I cannot do one push-up. So just FYI, like what I mean by 20-foot concrete wall. It takes like a whole process. Like I have to really be in the moment. I'm sure it comes way more naturally for you, especially because you've already written like nearly 10 books. So do you ever bump into moments like that?
Oh no, I think everyone bumps into those moments. I think, you know, it's natural to have those moments. A lot of people, you know, never finish a book because they only write when they're inspired to write. And you will never be inspired to write through an entire book. There will be days when, you know, every professional writer will tell you this, there will be days when you do not want to write, when you are not in love with the story anymore, when you hate the characters, you want to throw them off a building. I like to say those are the days that distinguish the professional writers from the non-professionals, because those are the days that you where it actually feels like work, then then that's your job, and you sit down and you do it. That being said, I have kind of over the last 10, 11 years, I've created kind of rituals that trick my mind into kind of getting into that place. Like I've actually blogged about this several times on my blog.
Please share.
Yeah. So like one of the things I do, I try to stick to a schedule. So I try to write around the same time every day. My big new thing, which I started about 2 years ago and has changed everything for me, is I write first thing in the morning before I do anything else. Like before I check email, before I even look at my phone. I don't turn on a television. I don't look at any websites. I have to write first. And that has been mind-blowingly like this huge change for me, because it really, really keeps me focused. So, you know, I wake up, I do a little meditation. I take my dog out, you know, to play ball, which is a little exercise. And then I sit down and I write, and I don't let myself check email or social media until I've written my 1,500 words. That's how many words I read a day.
Are you writing on a computer, by the way? Because that has a lot of... So you're very strong-willed. Because I'd be like, I think I have that one email from last night that I forgot to check. Right. You know, and then boom, like my day is gone. I'm like, oh my God.
I know. And it's so easy to do too. I keep my email program closed. If you do have problems with that, I recommend a program called Freedom, which actually shuts down your internet. Like you can't get it. You set it for like an hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever, and you cannot get to the internet. Yeah, so I do that. I write about 1,500 words a day, and then I kind of have the rest of the day off to do all the other things that need to be done.
How early in the morning are we talking? Are we talking like 4 a.m., 5 a.m., or 7?
No. I wake up around 7. And I wake up around 7. I have kind of my morning routine, which is, you know, the dog, the meditation. I do a little journaling. And then my butt's usually in the chair, although that's a bad description because I stand up when I write now.
Oh, okay.
But I'm usually writing by about 8, and then I'm usually done by 10. So I kind of tell myself, you know, any email that comes in can wait till 10 a.m. Like I've never gotten an email where it's like, if you don't respond by 9:59,
your house is going to burn down.
Yeah, your career is over. So I, you know, at the beginning, you have to continue to remind yourself that there will be no emails like that. Now it's just second nature. I barely ever get the temptation to check email anymore. I just found that, you know, when I would check email first thing in the morning, my brain would kind of go into the emails, and then there would be very little left for the story. And so that's one of the things I do. The other kind of trick I have is I don't drink coffee unless I'm writing. So the coffee works extra, extra well because I don't drink it throughout the rest of the day. So it's like my brain kind of goes, ooh, coffee, that equals creativity. It's like this really weird trick, but it works.
It's almost like rewarding yourself for writing as well with the coffee.
Yeah, and I love the coffee. Like it's really exciting. I like wake up and I'm like, yes, the coffee. You know, you deprive yourself all day. And then in the morning, you're like, if I write, I get coffee.
That's like tea for me. Like having tea, because I can't do coffee. It's too much for me. But with tea,
a lot of those,
I'm like an addict, especially green tea in the morning. There's this calm that just goes through my body once I sip that green tea. And I just feel like I can concentrate so much more and get so much more work done. So that's interesting that you say to withhold all type of, you know, whatever drink that you're addicted to, coffee or tea, until you're actually in the writing process. And that's the thing too that I was so curious about. It's that, gosh, you're like dishing out these books. Like it's like a lot of books, and you look super young. So I'm just like assuming that you're getting these done in like half a year each or something. So when you're sitting down, it's already 8 a.m., let's just say, and you're in the mood, you have the coffee in your hands. I think I caught you saying that you journal a little bit right before.
Yeah.
Does that lubricate the juices flowing in your head?
Maybe. I actually journal. What I do is I do a gratitude journal. So I list out things that I'm grateful for. Just kind of puts me in like a good headspace.
Oh, yeah, I love those.
You know, because a lot of times you wake up and you're like, oh, my book's not selling as well as I wanted it to. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you're thinking about all the things you don't have or you wish you had. And I think that's just not a good space to write from. It's just writing from a negative space, I think, never really results in anything good. So I try to put myself into a positive headspace. So I will list out 10 things I'm grateful for, you know, and some days they're really big, like, oh, I'm so grateful I have a new book out. You know, some things are really small, like I'm so grateful for my new phone, or I'm so grateful I'm healthy, or I'm so grateful, you know, that my dogs are healthy, or whatever it is. Because I think everyone can find 10 things they're grateful for. And to really set your focus on that in the morning shifts your entire day.
I also journal a little bit for the gratitude journaling.
Yeah.
And I do notice I have a lighter mind and a lighter heart.
Yeah.
And I'm more open to accepting things. I haven't found that that's really helped me with transitioning to writing per se for me personally. But I do notice, like, I took a writing workshop before and our teacher was saying to just journal about anything. Mm-hmm. Or she'll give us inspiration, like a photograph, and then she'll have us totally just look at the picture that's black and white, has nothing to do with us, just write. And then from there, I notice that's when I'm able to ease into whatever it is that I want to write about my own stuff. Just kind of like cranking the engine, you know, just like warming it up.
No, that makes sense. I know a lot of writers that actually start their day with a writing prompt. So, you know, you can Google writing prompts and there's like thousands of websites that have daily writing prompts. And I know a lot of people will start, I don't do this, but a lot of my writer friends do. Well, they'll just start with like 100 words on a writing prompt. And it just, it just kind of gets the wheels turning a bit, your mind warmed up. So I think, you know, whatever works, because like I said, not every day you're going to feel like, oh my God, I'm so inspired. I'm going to write 10,000 words. Like some days you're just like, no, I don't want to do it.
Oh, absolutely. So I'm assuming that you've had one of those days before.
Oh, tons. Tons.
So what do you do then? Do you just close your laptop and you're like, all right, you know what? Let me give myself a break for today and move on tomorrow. Or
no, I never do that.
Oh, okay. I like that.
I never let myself not write. Particularly, I think it's most important on the days that you don't want to. It's kind of like giving a temper tantrum child like exactly what they want. And your mind's going, I don't want to write. And you're going, okay. And then the next day your mind's going to be like, I don't want to write again. So with writing, it's all about habit. It's all about routine. And it's all about forward momentum with the story. And so what I do, I have a couple of different things. One is don't be afraid to write badly. Some days you're going to write total crap and it's okay because you wrote, you got stuff down on paper. And, you know, you always remember that you never have to keep anything that you write. That's the glory of writing. It's not live. It's not being tweeted to the world. It's just for you. And so if you don't write anything, you can't fix anything. My big thing is you sit down and you write the crap. You write crap until there's 1,000 words of crap on that page. And tomorrow you can delete it all. But at least you did it. And then the other thing I'll do is kind of along those lines, if I'm not inspired to write that scene that I have coming up in, you know, in my outline, I skip it. I put in like a little placeholder in brackets that says insert epic worthy, you know, James Bond worthy fight scene here. And then I move on. It's like future Jessica's problem, right? Like she will write the epic James Bond worthy fight scene. Like future Jessica never is very happy with past Jessica, but at least I've moved on and I wrote something else. Or like if you don't know what comes next, sometimes I'll just sit there and write some sort of backstory about my character that may never go in. Maybe one character mentioned something like, oh, you know, the time my dog got lost in the woods, and I'll go and I'll just write that scene, even though it'll probably never be in the book. At least I wrote.
I do love that. Thank you for sharing that awesome tip, by the way. And about your outlining, really quick, touching on that again. Yeah. Do you have a certain program that you use, or like a writing program or software that kind of collects your ideas of your outlines, or do you use note cards?
I used to use note cards, and then I started traveling a lot for the books. Oh, yes. And I found that like carrying the note cards around was just really cumbersome. So I actually use... I use a lot of different software, but Scrivener is a big one that a lot of people use.
Oh, I love Scrivener. Yeah, they were a sponsor on here before. Yeah, they're awesome.
Oh, great. Yeah, they are great. And I use them. I actually don't write in Scrivener. I know a lot of people do, which is totally fine. It's whatever works. I write in Word, but I outline in Scrivener because I love their corkboard view.
Oh, yes.
So
that's
an
awesome feature. Yeah.
I like being able to kind of move things around and create stacks and, you know, of cards and things. So I'll keep all my notes there. I also use Evernote a lot to keep all my notes in one place. I particularly like Evernote because it's an app on my phone and I can record notes to myself when I'm in the car or when I'm driving.
Like talking
and
Evernote
I'll do a lot.
Captures it.
Yeah, you can do Evernote. You can do picture notes, text notes, or audio notes.
I did not know that. That's awesome.
It's great. You know, it's a free app. It's great. So I will have a notebook for every book I'm working on. And because I don't know why, that my best ideas always come while I'm driving and I can't write them down. So I will just kind of get out my phone and start recording and I'll just speak it, you know, and I'll just say what the idea is and I'll kind of talk through the scene and it, you know, I'm the only one who hears it because it sounds really nerdy because I'm like, oh, and then she could say something like this and then I'll go, oh, cool. It's like really dorky. But like listening to it back when I get home is like always really funny. I love Evernote for kind of keeping all those brainstorms in one place. And then I usually use Scrivener to kind of lay it all out so I can see it visually.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing the apps that you use, because I think that really does make a big difference, because sometimes people have so many ideas, but they're not aware about what's out there that can help them capture their notes and all that stuff. And then they forget everything. So that's totally sucks. So yeah, like I've definitely heard of Scrivener. I've used Scrivener. They're amazing and a really fantastic team, by the way.
Really? Cool.
Yeah, really nice people. They started small and then just blew up. Like that's what I love about them. And then Evernote, I remember using it once. I used to run a blog with one of my other best friends, Amy, and we used Evernote for a little bit, and then I think we just got sidetracked and started using like emails and stuff. But I have to get back on Evernote and try the whole voice dictation.
Yeah, it's fantastic. That's my favorite feature of Evernote. They also have a work chat feature in Evernote. Like if you are working with someone else on a project, you can chat with them and your chats are like stored forever right in Evernote. So that's really helpful as well.
Jess, I would love to know, and again, I know you've written a lot of books, so I'm sure by now you see your growth or maybe patterns. Have you noticed if you've evolved creatively and how?
Oh, wow. What a question. You know, I think with every book, like I said, I try to challenge myself with every book. I try. Yeah. So I'm not really, you know, writing the same book over and over. And I'm always kind of keeping it fresh for myself.
Yeah. I mean, jumping into like writing a 3-part series too is very impressive, you know?
Yeah, like, that was so cool. That was a huge challenge. I mean, very difficult. And for instance, you know, my next challenge, I just sold my first middle grade book, which is like for 8 to 12-year-olds. So it's technically like tweens. So that was really fun to kind of write from a younger point of view. Thanks. That'll be out in February. It's called Addie Bell's Shortcut to Growing Up. So that was really fun. I would love to say that I've grown creatively. It's kind of hard to see it that way from my own point of view. But what I do think I've really been able to do is kind of, you know, which you can probably tell from my previous answers, is just really narrow down my process and like figure out what works for me and hone in on that so that I can get as much done in, with my day as possible. I mean, I write now about 4 books a year.
Jesus, woman, my God.
Yeah, but I mean,
that's
I love
so
it.
It's crazy.
Like, it's like so much fun for me, but it's all because I've pretty much like narrowed down what works for me. And I think, you know, I think like focus management is a huge part of it. Like just, you know, keeping yourself from getting too distracted by other things that don't matter or that don't contribute to your creativity. Just that kind of stuff has like really, really helped me. So I've become in the last couple of years, I've become really kind of obsessed with process, with focus management, with just kind of productivity, stuff like that.
That's awesome. I'm like, holy moly guacamole, 4 books a year. That's insane. I'm like, geez, it would take me 40 years. Now, with writing 4 books a year and with all that, what do you think is the hardest thing about writing that you've noticed for yourself?
You know, I think one of the hardest things for me, I'm very analytical, which you probably have noticed, being that I used to be a financial analyst and all that. Going along with this improving my process quest is I'm always trying to kind of find patterns in my writing process. And when I write a book, you know, it's like, oh, what's the hardest part of the book? Oh, you know, it's when you get to page 100 or it's when you get to this beat in the, you know, Blake Snyder beat sheet. But what I found was, this is like what I've learned in the past 10 years, is it's never the same spot. Like it's never the same thing that gives you a hard time in each book. It's always something new, and that's why it's always hard. For instance, like I'm trying to think of a specific, but like with my Unremembered trilogy, which is my sci-fi trilogy, the hardest part for me was the world building, because I'd never had to build my own world before. So, you know, I was like, oh, I got this. Like, I've written so many books. Like, this is going to be a piece of cake. And then I would get to the part where I'd have to like make up my own words and make up my own rules. And I was like, oh, I don't know how to do that. But Boys of Summer, I was like, oh, I'm back into the contemporary world. Like, you know, this is all the real world stuff. This is going to be a piece of cake. But then I would get into the problem of how do I interweave 3 different stories and make them all different and engaging? At what point do they interweave? Which is the most effective place to like overlap these stories? So I just think like with each book, there's a new challenge, and that's what keeps it interesting for me. But it's also kind of what keeps me on my toes, because I think if I were to have figured out my process to the point where I could like map it, it would just get boring. Like I'd be like, oh, here comes the hard part, you know, and then now here comes the easy part.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
I think it's like always something different.
I love that you appreciate those challenges and you take them head on. I think that's awesome.
I don't appreciate them in the moment. I will say that.
But that you're so good about it though. You push through. Oh my gosh. I feel like for me, I would try to push through, but I feel like if it gets really to a point where I'm just like running in circles, I'd have to walk away for a day or like half a day and then think about it again, you know?
Sometimes you have to do that. I try to write 1,500 words a day. Sometimes I get 500 and I'm like, this is all I got today. And I tell myself that's okay. Like tomorrow you'll write 2,000 or maybe you won't. To go back to your other question, I will say the easier parts for me are the beginnings. I really like the act one setup, setting up the character, setting up all the flaws and priming the story for what's to come. And then when it comes to like the middle where I'm like, oh, I have to pay off all the stuff that I set up, that's where I like really struggle on how to do it best.
I mentioned super quickly that you're awesome at marketing your work. And again, like I mentioned before, I heard about you first through one of my best friends who is one of the guys in your book trailers. And I never knew there were book trailers until your book trailer. I think it's so fascinating, number one, that there are book trailers. Number two, because you were doing it at a time when not many people were doing it. You know, you were doing it like years ago. And now I feel like it's caught on. It's almost like a necessity. Do you notice if there's like a spike in sales or in interests from readers? Do you recommend it for other authors?
I think there was a time when book trailers kind of had their heyday. I'm not sure that they're quite as popular as they were. I think, you know, in the book world, authors and publishers are always looking for the next thing, you know, like the next big thing to market your book. But I think the common thread, whether that be book trailers or interviews or competitions online or whatever it is, but I think the common thread is just finding ways for potential readers to interact with your story before they even pick up the book. And what the book trailers were able to do is kind of give people a visual touchstone, as books are normally not visual. You read them, they're on paper. So having the book trailers, which I filmed to look like movie trailers, they really kind of brought you into the story and made the story feel real. And I think that was like an interaction between the reader and the book or the story. You know, nowadays I search for other ways to do that. I try to do a lot of like contests online or some sort of engagement competitions where I'm asking people to talk about their favorite boy in The Boys of Summer or take the quiz so that they're kind of interacting with the story in different ways. You know, I wish I could say like, oh, this is the secret to marketing. You have to do this, this, and this. I don't think I've figured that out yet. I try a lot of different things. Some things work, some things don't. In the end, you know, you just kind of have to, you have to just kind of keep going. I mean, they say the best way to market a book is to write more books. So that's, you know, something I try to do as well, is just keep writing them as well as try to get them out there.
Which social media account, like whether it's Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, have you found has given you the most engagement with readers or interest from readers?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's something that everyone's trying to figure out right now.
Yeah.
You know, what is the best way to do it? I am on all the things, you know, like I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. I'm trying to figure out, you know, what to do on each medium. And I found when you're writing for teens, a lot of the teens are not on Facebook anymore. And a lot of them aren't even on Twitter. Instagram and Snapchat is where the teens are these days, is what I've been told. I have definitely most of my teen readers follow me on Instagram or Snapchat and not Facebook. Facebook, I have more of kind of the adult crowd, the teachers, the librarians, the readers who are adults but like teen fiction, and I love those people too. I found that, you know, I teach a lot of online workshops, and I find that Facebook is the best way to reach other writers who are looking for those kinds of things. But in terms of the readers that are directly reading my book, I find that they're more on the Instagram and Snapchat. However, you know, that being said, I'm on these social media things every day, and I put a lot of effort into it. But then I do a lot of school visits, so I'll go to a school, I'll sit with a group of, you know, 13, 14-year-olds, and I'll say, okay, raise your hand if you've ever found a book because of Instagram. You know, it's like no one raises their hand. And then I'll ask them, like, where do you find the books that you're going to read? And they'll say, from my friends. So I think, you know, it's no matter what you do, like there's this word of mouth grassroots element that you just can't control. And I think what we try to do as authors, and I think your publishers are doing this as well, is you want to get it into the hands of that one teen or that one reader who's going to go to school and be like, this was the best book I ever read. How do you know who that person is? You don't. But the more teens you can get in front of, the more chances you are that you're going to hit one of those, you know, sellers who really kind of help you spread that word. And if you can hit 10 of those, and they are all the kind of people who can reach 10 people, then you're getting, you know, 100 different readers from just those 10. So, you know, it's like, it's a kind of a win and lose situation. Like, you want to do it all because you want to know that you're doing it and you're trying. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, like, the teens, they find their books from their friends. And so, there's not much you can do about that.
You know what that reminds me of? Book bloggers. Like, they call themselves book bloggers. And what was it? What's another one?
Booktubers.
Which one?
Booktubers.
Yeah. Booktubers.
Yeah.
And bookstagrams and whatnot. And I'm like, oh my God, like, my mind is blown with this whole world of Instagram. Now it's like the coolest in thing. Instead of your latest fashion of what you're wearing, it's like, what's the latest book you're reading? Oh my gosh, imagine like getting into like the right booktuber who genuinely loves your work. Oh my goodness, what that could do. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, the teen fans are really excited and they're really adamant about what they like and they're happy to post it. And I think that's great. There's definitely kind of a collector's item thing about books these days, which is giving me a lot of hope for, you know, the future of paper books because the teens, they still prefer to hold books. They still prefer to be able to hold something in their hand and turn pages. You know, they've been doing studies over and over and teens still prefer hardcover paperback books over ebooks. And a lot of that is coming out in what you're seeing on Instagram, where they're doing the book rainbows or, you know, or they're doing the book color wheels and fun pictures with the books, which you can't do with an ebook. That always just kind of gives me hope because, you know, I'm a big fan of ebooks, but I'm also a really big fan of the paper books and I hope they don't go away.
I know, me too.
So yeah, I do think they're out there. It's just a matter of figuring out where they're, you know, hanging out.
Okay, in contrast to that, what I was asking you about, like the whole, you know, which type of marketing technique have you noticed works best for you? Have you made any like big boo-boos in the marketing world where you're like, oh man, I'm never going to do that again?
I don't know if I have any like really big ones where I'm just like, oh God, I'm never going to do that again. I love rewarding the readers that exist, like that, my fans, the fans that follow me from book to book, like I love giving them something. And I think, you know, when you follow me on Instagram, like I kind of have an idea that you either have read one of my books or you're interested in my books, which is great. So I try to offer like special things just for my followers or just for my fans. Like with the Unremembered trilogy, I did for, I think it was for the third book. If you pre-ordered the third book, you could get a free poster with like a map of the kind of the world that I had built. It was signed and all of that. And
wow, was, you know, that your idea? Or was that like the
Yeah, that was my idea.
Dang, so get it, girl.
I had the map designed, like I commissioned a map designer. I had the maps printed. I mean, it was such a fun process to like bring this world to life with this map. And, you know, and I sent them to all of the people who had pre-ordered and we got a good number of pre-orders and it was definitely expensive to ship them. Sometimes, you know, I'll do something like that and I'll be like, oh God, that was really expensive. You know, was that really worth it? But then, you know, you see people like the people on Instagram, they're posting pictures of those posters when they arrive in the mail and it just reminds you that it is worth it to get those gifts to those super fans. I have a new book coming out in August called A Week of Mondays and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what can I do for the people who buy that one early, like, because and anyone who's buying it early is probably a fan already. So, you know, I want to reward that. And I'm trying to come up with what else can I do for the fans in terms of what has not worked. You know, like sometimes I'll send like a tweet and it's just like nothing will happen. You know, get no likes, no retweets. And I'll kind of learn from that. You know, I'll be like, okay, that tweet didn't work. Because I've found that the stuff you post on Facebook does not work on Twitter and vice versa.
I'm learning that too. I'm like, oh, copy and paste does not work in this world.
No, I know. It really does. Like with Twitter, you have to, because there's so much content and it's just streaming through these feeds so fast, you have to really find the things that are going to capture people and engage them. And I think with Twitter, it's all about engagement. So it's like asking questions, putting up polls.
And like images, you know, like asking too, them for advice. Right?
Yeah, images, feedback. You know, like I'll see authors post things like, oh, I'm trying to decide what to name this character, A, B, or C, you know, and then they'll get tons of engagement. So things like that, I think, work really well on Twitter. On Instagram, it's funny because I'll put like a picture of my book and I'll get like 100 likes or something. And then I'll put a picture of like my dog and I'll get like 300 likes. So I started actually putting pictures of my dogs with my books.
Hell like, yes, that's smart.
And then those would like get the most. But yeah, you just kind of figure out what are people stopping on, because it's like a scroll society, right? Everyone's just scrolling with their finger. And true. What's actually going to cause them to lift their finger and pause on that picture. And it's like cute things. That is number one, cute stuff. Dogs, cats, babies. So I'm like totally pimping out my dogs now.
Have you tried the hashtags for Instagram? Because they really do work.
I haven't, I do. I make up my own stupid hashtags. Like I haven't really been all that on the hashtags. I probably should be better about it.
Hashtag YA lit is huge. You know, young adult bookstagram, the hashtag Goodreads, all those hashtags truly have helped.
That's great. That's really good to know.
The whole marketing thing is so tricky because, you know, going into it as a writer, I think I'm more so from that mindset like, oh, well, in a way, we're all artists, you know, like we shouldn't have to worry about that. But then in the end of the day, it's like, okay, your art is your art. It's true. But it needs to get out somehow so that your art can touch people, can move them the way you wanted it to. Marketing is really important that I'm learning, you know, and just to learn to embrace it. I've met some people, like whether it's actors and or writers who are like, I'm not about that social media life. People will find me and like, yeah, but, you know, there's a lot of artists nowadays. Mm-hmm. Good luck. You know, so it's like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you just got to make a little bit of effort so that people can find your work if it's not being found just yet. It's fascinating. And I love talking about the marketing side. Actually, it's really cool. Thank you for delving into that side with me.
Sure.
You know, really super quick. You mentioned something just now, and I am curious. I wanted to ask you before, but it slipped my mind. I know you write from 8 a.m. till about 10 a.m., but mm-hmm. are you writing full time or?
I'm a full-time author. I don't have any other jobs. Like I did mention, I do teach a little bit.
Before that, have you ever been in that situation where you had to have a side job?
Yeah, I mean, once I left MGM Studios, once the layoffs happened, basically I had a 6-month severance and I didn't sell my book for a year and a half. So, you know, you do the math. That's a whole year of like no income.
Because I know you mentioned severance at the beginning. Was that enough to hold you through?
Oh, no, it was not. Okay. I mean, so what I did was, you know, by that time I'd kind of made a decision. I was like, I'm going to be a writer. I mean, that's my decision. I'm going to tell the universe that that's what I want to do and I'm going to make it happen. And, you know, once I kind of made that decision, then it was like, okay, but here's the reality of the situation. You still have to pay rent. You still have to, you know, make payments on the car, all the things. So what I did was I ended up taking a lot of odd jobs, kind of miscellaneous items, because my big priority was that I wanted to be able to make my own schedule. I didn't want to go back to a 9-to-5 where I would get home at 6 o'clock and be so exhausted that I couldn't write.
Yeah.
So I took on all these odd jobs that I would find like on Craigslist. Worked for a transcription company for a while. So I would listen to recordings from meetings and I would transcribe them because I'm a very fast typist. I would do that from like midnight to like 4 a.m. because they would be overnight turnarounds. And so that would allow me
to... How was the pay rate for that? Was that like doable?
I mean, that wasn't all I did. I had like this collection of jobs.
Oh, yes,
so like
yes.
I would do that. The pay was fine. It just wasn't enough volume to actually make a living. I did some data entry work for some, you know, small businesses. I worked as the catering server. So I would cater the catering events. Like I would like make omelets, you know, at like breakfast events and things. I just took on all of these really odd jobs that basically the criteria for me was, can I do it on my own time? Can I set my own hours? Can I leave my mornings for writing? Because it was important to me to prioritize the writing. So that's how I got through for the first year and a half until I sold my first book. And then I've just been selling books since then. But
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you do what you have to do. You do what works. Like if you know this is what you're meant to do, if you know that this is your dream, like you can make it happen. And it may take a year, it may take 10 years, it may take a month. Like it's different for everyone. But if you're committed to it, you'll do what it takes.
That's very inspiring. Thank you for that. I think it's really important for listeners to understand that you need to focus on what it is that your heart is set on. And if that means juggling several different jobs at the same time, then make it happen. Okay, so I know we were talking about, we mentioned a little bit that you do teach. So mm-hmm. I'd love to know, where is it that you teach and what do you teach?
Well, I do teach for Save the Cat. I do some occasional workshops for them. So I teach how to use the Save the Cat beat sheet to outline novels. I don't have any on the schedule right now for that. But most recently, I launched an online on-demand class. So it's basically a class you can take whenever you want, at any pace you want. It's on a site called Udemy, which is spelled U-D-E-M-Y.
Oh, yes. I've definitely heard of Udemy. They're huge.
Yeah. Yeah, they're huge. And so I launched a class just about 2 weeks ago. It's all about how to come up with high concept ideas. A high concept idea is basically like a really commercial idea for a book or screenplay that has a better chance of selling than another kind of an idea. I just launched a class on how to brainstorm and develop high concept ideas, the course. You know, that's been really fun. I have some more Udemy classes in the works that I'll be launching. I found that When I was teaching the live classes, it was harder to fill the classes because, you know, not everyone can make it to that location. Not everyone can make it on those dates. So I started leaning towards the Udemy model where I record the class. I spend a lot of time and effort putting together like a really good high quality production value content class. Then people can just do it whenever they want. They can do it at night. They can do it in their own time. It's all done on the computer. So that's been a really cool model for me because it allows me to share the content that I want to share. And then it allows my students to absorb that content whenever it's most convenient for them.
That is amazing. Congratulations, by the way, because I know you mentioned it was 2 weeks ago that it was just launched. And have you noticed like a growth, people who are interested in your work specifically, like, oh my gosh, Jessica Brody, she's a teacher. What has she written? Have you noticed like a spike in that a little bit?
I think I'm starting to. We had a really good launch. I think we have almost 100 students so far.
Congrats.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's been really great. I had people who were always asking me, like, when are you going to teach another workshop, things like that. And so a lot of those people are gravitating towards these kind of on-demand classes that they can take whenever they want. I'm hoping that as the course gains momentum and as more people find it on the Udemy website and catalog, I will introduce people to my books. But to be honest, for the Udemy course, it's really not my goal. My goal is to share the wisdom, share advice to writers. I love talking to other writers. I love helping them. It's why I teach for Save the Cat. It's why I've put these classes together, because for me, there's no more rewarding experience than when someone says, I took your class and I got this great idea, or I took your class and I finally figured out what was wrong with my book and now it's amazing. You know, like
That's awesome. Is
really rewarding for me.
Oh, so, yeah, I can imagine. Now, you being a teacher, do you have any advice that you've received you want to pass on to your students and the listeners?
I touched upon it briefly before, but I have a quote on my wall. It wasn't a direct piece of wisdom given to me, but I read this quote by Nora Roberts, who's obviously a very prolific writer.
Yes.
I don't know how many books she has, but I'm guessing it's close to 100.
Yeah.
She has there's a quote on my wall that I look at whenever I'm struggling, and it says, you can't fix a blank page. Mm. And that is what really puts my butt in the chair or standing desk, as it were, every single day is, you know what? Like, I may not feel like writing today, but I need something to fix later. And I can't fix it unless I write something terrible first. So, you know, I've kind of taken that wisdom and I've transferred it into my, you know, my message, which is don't be afraid to write badly. Just write, even if it's horrible and you no one will ever read it, at least you wrote and at least you have something to fix. You know, I'm a big fan of you can't decorate the house until it's built. So a lot of writers get so stuck on like, oh, but this chapter doesn't, it's not right. The writing isn't pretty. My philosophy is it doesn't matter. Like, just build the house first. Lay the foundation, figure out where the walls are going to be before you can go, I want to hang this photograph, or I want to choose this carpeting. You won't even know how much carpeting to buy until you know how big the room is, you know. So it's things like that that I'm a big fan of, is just get it out and fix it later. So I think that all kind of stems back from the Nora Roberts can't fix a blank page. The other one I use a lot, don't be afraid to write crap. Crap makes great fertilizer.
Yes, I love that. Yes, tweetable, done and done.
Tweetable.
I love that.
It's like the perfect 140 characters.
If it's okay with you, can I wrap it up with two more questions?
Yes, absolutely.
Amazing. So, second to last one, have you been to any writer's retreat that you can recommend for me or my listeners to check out?
Oh gosh, such a good question. You know, I feel weird because I was like kind of that person who never went to these things because I was too shy. And
really?
Yeah, I know. I was just like, when I decided to become a writer, it was very like, oh, I'm going to just stay in my little cave and not talk to anyone, which was a big mistake.
You sound so outgoing. Oh my goodness.
I am now. I just wasn't at the time. And I think like I was so kind of afraid of meeting other writers because I still was like suffering from imposter syndrome, which was like, I'm not good enough.
Oh yeah, I totally get that.
So it was like, if I go out and meet other writers, I'm going to have to like, you know, admit that. So I haven't been to a lot of these kinds of events. I will say though, that, you know, one of the big ones that everybody talks about that everyone loves is SCBWI, which stands for Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. It's great for young adult and children's writers and illustrators, and they have lots of conferences. They have lots of chapters. I know that Romance Writers of America is also a very good one. They have local chapters all over the country, and you do not have to be a romance writer to join. There's mystery writers that are members. There's young adult writers. So that's always a good one. Go to SaveTheCat.com and at least, like, sign up for the newsletter and get their blogs because they have amazing blogs every week. And they also do a lot of workshops and things like that. So I would recommend that. But I apologize. I don't have like that one that I was
stop.
Like,
don't even apologize, please. I totally threw that question at you and you did not see it coming. So thank you for that. And like, that's already like, you know, listen, not all writers go to writers retreats or conferences or whatnot. You know, like we mentioned, a lot of writers do like to write at home, you know, whether it's they first started, they were a little bit insecure and then like, or just they're shy. And I totally get that. You know, there's, like you said, do whatever works for you, right? And I think that's good to hear too. It's like for not everybody's, you know, into writers retreats. So there are people out there, even if they want to, they don't have access to writers retreats or don't live close enough to like awesome conferences. So I'm sure this makes them feel better too, to know that like it's still doable without having to go to these things, you know?
I like to tell new writers, like, don't do it how I did it. Join some sort of group, whether that's online or in your hometown, because I think if I were to go back and do things over, I would surround myself with more writers. And now I have tons and tons of writer friends. I think being around writers just keeps you sane. I mean, we're an interesting lot. Like, we are definitely our own creatures. And, you know, you have to kind of find your tribe. And if you're introverted and you don't like being around people, then join something online. Join a Facebook group of writers. Join a critique group, online critique group. But I think the more you can surround yourself with writers, the easier time you're going to have with the whole process of getting published or whatever your goals might be.
Thank you. And the last recommended books. I love asking about what like favorite books you've read. Please share with us if you can remember any off the top of your head.
Well, of course, Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, obviously. I've already kind of, you know, been over that one over and over again. I'm a big fan of Tim Ferriss and the 4-Hour Work Week. He's got a great podcast, a great blog. Yes. Like, he's just kind of one of those people that thinks outside the box and challenges every single assumption that you have about your life and about the way your mind works. And I think the more you can do that, the better. I'm a huge fan of Tim and his books and his content. In terms of fiction, like, I just have so many books that I love. I think one of my favorite books of all time is Room by Emma Donahue, which of course was made into a movie that was nominated for an Academy Award, which just like made my whole life feel worthwhile.
That's amazing.
This is one of my favorite books of all time. I've reread it like a million times. Funny enough, one of the reasons that I decided to pursue a career in writing was because of the book Bridget Jones's Diary by Helen Fielding.
Nice.
It was like the first book that like really spoke to me as a person, and I felt she was writing it specifically for me, and I had never really read a book like that before.
Awesome.
I guess that's a spectrum of different lifestyle writing fiction.
Thank you so much. You've been amazing. That wraps up our episode with Jessica Brody. Thank you so much for sharing all those amazing tips, Jessica. I had so much fun talking about the ins and outs of the writing processes and diving into the social media and marketing aspect of reaching readers. A huge thank you to you listeners for tuning in as always. Jessica's offering a special 50% off discount for 88 Cups of Tea listeners for anyone interested in checking out the class she's teaching on Udemy. Head over to jessicabrody.com/ideas. 50. That's the number 50. To say hi to Jessica, you can find her on Twitter at Jessica Brody. I've been loving your messages and emails about the podcast and have been listening to what you're looking for. A lot of you have reached out asking about writing communities and classes, and I'm so excited to tell you more about Gotham Writers. If you're working on your own children's book, anything from a picture book to young adult novels, I really want you to listen to why Gotham is an incredible asset to writers. They started in my favorite city of all time, New York City, my home where a lot of my dreams came true. Just like me, Gotham also believes that everyone has a story to tell, and they exist just so they can help writers like you tell your story better. You learn from teachers who are accomplished writers and are amazing at teaching. Through lectures, writing exercises, and workshopping, you learn how to enter the psyche of young people with a grown-up sense of craftsmanship. Gotham teaches writers all the elements of craft in a way that best resonates with young readers, and better yet, you'll learn how to entertain and enlighten young minds. On top of making progress on your work, Gotham will also introduce you to the ways of the business. They've put a lot of heart and soul into creating a safe and structured environment for writers to learn for over 20 years. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/gothamwriters to check out their classes. They have a super supportive staff that will help you find the course that's perfect for you. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.